my name is Lila. Yeah, there he is. They called it Lila over in East Texas. Lila Marguerite. That was my name. I'm awfully glad to be here tonight. And it's been a whole lot to me to have this quiet time this afternoon. I took a little inventory this afternoon and I figured out that I really didn't get sick. That maybe it was sort of a throwback. I felt like I wasn't getting enough attention and not knowing anything else to do, I just threw up. I don't know any other way to talk except the way I always did what happened. I mean, what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And I know so many of you all have heard me so many times, but I know there's some new members here, and that's the ones I try to talk to, is the new man or woman that may feel very alone in his newness in this program and hasn't realized yet, perhaps, that as long as he lives, he or she will never be alone again. And that, to me, is the most comforting thought I suppose I ever had, because like so many of you, alcoholism for me was the lonely disease. I have, by the grace of God, been sober one day at a time since July 15th, 1964. And every day of it has been a reprieve from hell. I know. When I first came to this program, I didn't know anything about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I only knew that my sister had joined it, and her husband, and I knew that they had a terrific drinking problem. And I remember asking my mother what they did up there at the club, and she said, well, she didn't know, but they drank soup, and they had some coffee, and she said she guessed they put something in the coffee. I think she's thinking about saltpeter or something like that. But she was sure that they must have something in the coffee that turned them against liquor because they were staying sober. So it was a brand new world for me when I came to AA. And thank God it was, because I couldn't have stood that old one very much longer. I came to AA 20 years ago. In fact, I haven't had a drink continuously in over 16 years, as I said, but I first came to this program 20 years ago, and I never left it except to get drunk. I knew from the first time I was ever there that it was for me and the only answer for me. But the first year, I had a lot of trouble. I'd slip and I'd slide, and I had a husband then. I've had husbands off and on all my life, too. I got real smart, and I haven't had but one relapse in that direction in almost 15 years. I have learned to say no, you know. It wasn't easy. But I figured I had my limit. I mean, if you can't make it with five, you may as well give up. So there must be a little something wrong with me as well as them. It could not be all them. My mother said it's only natural for a woman to meet one son of a bee in her lifetime, but I had had four at that time. And, of course, she blamed it on me and my condition. She said it was those men I married. She didn't know what those poor men went through. I had made so much unhappiness in this world when I look back on it that if I live to be 100, I'll never be able to make amends for all of it. And some of it, I guess it's too late. I never talked much about my sister. And a lot of people didn't know I had one. But she was an alcoholic too, and she went into AA, as I said before, I did. And she stayed sober about 7 years and started having trouble. And she died last June. I don't know what the doctor's certificate said, the death certificate, but she died of alcoholism and an overdose of narcotics. I think if people really knew the truth about what kills so many people in this world, maybe more of the people would try to do something about it, but you'd be surprised. They had fatty liver and everything else on that poor little thing's death certificate, but she didn't die just of a fatty liver. She had had many, many years of slipping and sliding, trying to get back and just couldn't. And I thought of that little story of the bee behind the windshield of the car, and a fella back home named Bruce said, you know, to a little bee, that windshield's just hard air. And I think she beat her wings against that hard air so long she just couldn't find that move, that few inches it would have taken to find the open window. And like the little bee, she died right there in the crevice with looking out at what life could be if she could just reach it. I started drinking when I was just a child, because at that time it was smart. I am awfully old. When I talk about things, you might not think some of it's true, but I can be truthful with you because you'll probably never get down to Texas, some of you. But last June, I was 52 years old. And in a way, I am so glad that God has let me survive this many years, because there was a time in my early 30s when I thought I'd never live to see 40. And then there was a time I thought I'd never get to 45. But by His grace, one day at a time, I have lived a full life, and I am so grateful for it. I came to AA when I was a very young woman. I guess some of the members in the group might have thought I hadn't drank enough or had enough trouble when they first saw me, because I was only 30 or 31 when I first came. And I was the youngest woman in the group, and certainly the men were older. And I think they sort of petted me at first, like they would, like they say, the white-haired, fair-haired boy, and they paid so much attention to me in the beginning. Of course, if we slip long enough, they don't give up. They just give out, and they gave out many, many times on me. They'd put me in hotels and sit with me in shifts and give me the Kansas City treatment, a little whiskey and whatever else they give you to taper you off. And if they went to sleep, I'd taper myself right back on as quick, begging every breath, please help me, and then trying to find where they hid the bottle. To me, there may be another drunk in me, but I don't think there's another sobering up. Because that final moment of truth, when you have to say to yourself, this is the life strength I can't take anymore, to me is living death. When you want somebody so much and your body and mind is craving that one more drink, just one more drink. To make a decision is the hardest thing in this world. To lay the bottle down and say, this is it, I'm ready to go and sober up and not have any more. I don't know if I'd have the courage, the plain old guts it sometimes takes, to say, no, I'm ready to go with you and help me sober up. We say alcoholism is a progressive disease, and I know certainly it is, because we get older and we get tireder. And I know if I took a drink today, it would probably just kill me right off the bat. They say if we stay sober 10 years and take a drink, that we don't end up like go back to where we left off in our drinking. We're 100 times worse because time has passed. And even though sober, it is a progressive illness. All my life seemed like there had been problems of one kind or another. It was never smooth sailing, and we ask God to return us to sanity, and sometimes people would say to return us to a former sane way of living and a constructive way of thought. Well, I could never remember a time in my life that hadn't been all screwed up and kooky, you know. I've been a screwball ever since I can remember. I've been different. I felt different, and I couldn't get along with other people. I could get along with them, I just didn't communicate, because I used to not talk. I can talk now, But when I was growing up, I couldn't say two words to a person because I was worried about what they might think of me and that it might be silly. Because from the first, I felt inadequate and inferior, and I was inferior in many ways. I used to read a lot, and that's bad if you read the wrong things. And I read these Happy Ever After things, and I expected my life to turn out like that too, but I was raised in the Depression, and it was a real depression. I mean, we were raised on potatoes and beans and a little meat on Saturday because that's all we could afford, and steak was 25 cents a pound then. So you can see how bad it was. And breakfast, we had gravy and biscuits. So life just wasn't turning out like I was reading about in those books. But the books helped because I escaped even as a child. Life wasn't what I wanted, and I escaped in reading about other people and trying to be what they were in my mind. When I got a little bit older, I started getting interested in boys, and that was my downfall. Okay, because in my condition, I was real skinny and looked just like a boy, you know, from behind. I wasn't, I didn't have the usual fancy things that girls get. I was just real plain, and boys didn't like me. And I had something else wrong, too. I was riding a bicycle one time, and I broke my two front teeth. And to a woman with no front teeth, your life's just shot to start with. And I remember that was an obsession with me growing up, if I could just get my two front teeth back. But when I was going to school, I was the craziest looking kid you ever saw. I wore high heels before it was time to. And I painted my face, and I had mascara on my eyes. I was a freak. And I used to work at Woolworth, and one Christmas they gave me a mirror for Christmas, and it had the little legend under it, "Would the gods suggest to give us to get, see ourselves as others see us," and it just broke my heart because I knew what they were thinking about me. But, you know, I couldn't help it. I was trying to be something I was not, and I wanted to be grown because it seemed like the grown people was the only ones ever had any fun. So I put on my high heels and my long dress and my flapper haircut and lipstick, and away I went, ridiculous little urchin that I was. I started going to church when I was quite young because I had a Sunday school teacher who really loved people. I thought that years later, you don't meet many people who really love people like she did. And I had a lot of faith in her because she cared about me. She'd pick me up, three times a week, I guess, to take me to church. And I wouldn't have gone otherwise because we lived too far from town, and Daddy was usually drunk on Sundays, weekend, and Mother never could go to church because she didn't have a good dress. That was always her excuse. Well, when we get settled, when I get a good dress, I'm going to take you to church, and we're going to do this and that. But we were always one of those going-to-do families. We never did. We just sat at home. And she kept all her wedding china packed in a big trunk for when we got settled and got a better house and the things finally burned up without ever being used. We hid any beautiful thing we might have had because we were saving it till that far future time when things were going to be better, the beautiful house, the good clothes, and all that kind of stuff. So we really never lived. There was no show of affection in my family. I'm quite sure that Mother and Daddy loved each other because they've been together more than 50 years, and you can't argue with success. But they never showed it around the kids. I never remember seeing him kiss her before us or even put his arm around her unless he was drinking. So I think that was sort of a mental quirk with me too, growing up, of being unable to let people know that I love them. I might be loving them to death, but I just couldn't show it, not till I got a drink. Alcohol solved a lot of problems for me in the beginning, I thought. it opened me up and let me loose so I could love people and tell them so, and dance and do all the things that young girls like to do. But I didn't know it was going to go the opposite way, though, and make me go overboard in this loving business. I made a great big mistake when I was quite young. As I said, I went to church, and I knew right from on in the church I went to, there wasn't any middle road. I mean, you did some things, you were just a deep dyed sinner. And to me, with my perfectionism, I thought once I had thrown my slipper over the moon, whatever they call it, it was too late to ever get back to respectability. And that's exactly what I did. With my makeup, I wanted somebody to love me. And I had been reading these love stories. And I would sit around wondering what it'd feel like if a boy kissed you, you know, and that's dangerous thinking. That's stinking thinking for a young girl. And I would listen to the old folks talk about women. Sometimes they were big gossips in our family. They could tear a person apart in 2 minutes. And they were talking about this woman one time. They said she's ruined. And that just fascinated me. I couldn't wait to find out what she did to get ruined. And then I met this fellow out at the Green Acres Dance. There's no country dance, and he was a little older than I was. So I found out what they're talking about. And the only way I know to tell it is was out in the woods. If you're old enough, somebody to remember that song, "She Had to Go and Lose It at the Astor." Well, it was in the Piney Woods of East Texas. And I found out later, taking an inventory, I used to say it was all his fault. But being honest, I know that I collaborated because I helped him carry the back seat out of the car and set it out. I held up my end, and we got it out there under them pine trees. And I remember looking up at that old moon, and I said, "Marguerite, you're going to hell. But it's too late to stop then." And after that, I had a worse attitude toward myself, a feeling of worthlessness and unworthiness of having known right from wrong and having let this occurrence happen. I felt like everybody in this dog was better than I was, and I thought that no decent man, well, that's what they said, the old folks said, you know, about people, no decent man would ever have her. And I thought, well, that being the case, you might as well just relax and do what comes naturally, because you're not ever going to have a good life anyway. I think that attitude of defeatism has kept more drunks drinking, because we get the feeling that I've ruined my life anyway, and we have to drink to forget some of it, to live with ourselves. That's one of the things I have had to do in AA. They don't tell us to forgive ourselves just to be saying it, because until I learned to live with Marguerite and like her enough, I don't know how to put it. I had to learn to love myself enough to take care of myself. I couldn't keep condemning me for the things that I had done in the past, because I could not live sober and remember. I would have gone insane had I thought I had to be responsible for my past. And the only way that I could live with myself was to stay half drunk, because it didn't seem so bad then. And in AA, when they told me I had to first forgive myself, that saved my life. Because I asked them, "Well, how in the world can you forgive yourself for things?" They say, "Well, God forgives you. And if someone that great and powerful can forgive, why can't you forgive yourself, a mere woman?" And that helped me. And then they said to me, "Make amends to people. Put yourself at the top of the list, because we have hurt ourselves far worse than we've ever hurt family or friends or business associates or anybody else." And they said, "Marguerite, be good to yourself. Go to AA. Go to all the meetings you can get to. Don't get too tired. Don't get too hungry," and all the things they told me to do in the beginning. And they said, "Be good to yourself." And that helped. Because I didn't have any respect for me when I came to AA. And I had very little respect for anybody else. We drunks think that people let us down. And all my life, I thought that people had let me down. I didn't realize till I got on the program a little bit that I was the one that had caused all this. And that was the only way I could reason it in my mind, that I could forgive everybody that had ever harmed me, because had I not been drinking, it could they would never have been alive to hurt me. So therefore, I had only myself to blame for all these things. So I could forgive them, and I had to forgive myself. And that's how that part worked for me. The time came when I wanted to get married. Well, I always wanted to get married. I don't particularly today, but I used to all the time, because that was the recipe for a happy life. You read about it, and your mama says so, and everybody in general says the only way for a girl to be happy is to get married and have children and a happy home. In that order, preferably. So, when, even though I knew that I was unworthy, I was working in this pants factory, and sewing on buttons. I was a button girl, and I like to remember that, because we had those old Hager pants, slacks, and we always put 5, I think, buttons down the fly. I nearly forgotten, but that's all. I couldn't even have to think about what I was doing. It's a good job if you don't want to have to think about it. And you can just push the button in, push the foot down, on goes the button, and you can think about anything you want to. And so I just drained away the days sewing those buttons down the front of the men's pants. And then they had this manager that was very strong man, and I kept looking at him, and I wanted a baby so bad. I always did things backwards, but I wanted a baby first, and then I decided he was it. And so I got him one way or another. We women have twisted little ways of getting a man to ask you to marry him. You know, they think they catch us, but they don't. We catch them. We just run a while and then stop and let them catch up. Anyhow, I thought he had let me down too, because, well, in the beginning he was so handsome and so different, and that's what I was looking for, people that were different and interesting. And he was just a little bit more interesting and different than I had anticipated, because he went to state asylum when my baby's about 6 months old, and he's still there. The baby came, and I didn't know exactly how to take care of it, but before it came, I stayed sober. I thought that this was a second chance, and I'd stay sober and have a good life. And nobody ever loved any child more than I loved my little first one, Johnny, and I treated him the worst. It was like a child with a doll, because I had no more sense of responsibility. When I thought about marriage, I thought of the romantic part, the good things, the excitement. There was never the everyday. The everyday world killed me. The plain old breathing in and out, you know, and going to work and going home. The monotony of everyday existence bored me to death. I had to keep something ahead to look forward to. And anything I went into, it was always the good things of it, never the obligations or the duties or the real things of life. I didn't want to have anything to do with. I wanted the gaiety, the bright lights, the romance of marriage, the romance of motherhood, but never the drudgery. I could never face life as it really was. So, as usual, I ran away. Anything in my life that got too much, I ran away, one way or another. If I couldn't run physically, I got drunk. Because drunk, nobody can expect anything of you. So in any situation that I couldn't handle, there was always the solution to get drunk. When I got so disgusted with myself, I couldn't live one more minute with me. I could ease the pain by getting drunk. My world kind of fell apart when Paul went to the asylum, because I really didn't know he was sick when I married him. Somebody kidded me once, said, "Margaret, what'd you do to run that old boy crazy?" Well, I didn't do anything. It's kind of like that joke about the drunk they accused of setting the bed on fire. And he said, "I didn't do it. It was on fire when I got in." So I'm quite sure that he was sick when the marriage began. So I thought, in my usual fashion, I'll write him off. That's another out of alcoholics or people like me. If something gets in your way, just write it off. So I left him there, and I didn't go back for 20 years. I go back now, but for many years I forgot, tried to forget that he was there because it hurt my conscience. I didn't want to think about him there because I couldn't help but think there might have been something I could have done maybe to make him better. My boy, I didn't intend to ever tell that his father was there because I thought it might ruin his life if he knew his father was crazy. He might fear for his own sanity. Some things, I guess we get the idea things are hereditary. And I didn't want to ever remember that poor crazy man back there in Terrell, but I did remember from time to time, and it was one of the things that hurt and tormented. I got a divorce. I had heard you couldn't, and I still don't know how I did, but I got one. I sort of went hog wild. There must be in some of us. I know there are some women that certainly didn't drink like I did. They stay at home, and they have just as big a problem, but they don't get out on the street and just go crazy like I did. We all have our patterns, and just in case there may be some woman here tonight that is afraid really to let people know just what you have really been like, you don't have to be afraid. We're all different in one way or another. Our main thing in common, of course, is our drinking, that we can't handle one drink without taking more than we intend and have no control over that first drink. But we all have different patterns, and because yours was a little bit different from some other women's, certainly there is no shame if we truly believe alcoholism is an illness. I know sometimes we might parrot-like mouth that sentence, that alcoholism is an illness, because if we truly believe it, we'll cut out some of this condemning of ourselves for our sinful past. Because really, you can't call it a sin if you were a sick person mentally, physically, spiritually sick from the disease of alcoholism. You can't condemn yourself for being a sinner, per se. I have no reticence about telling you about me, because when I came to AA, they said we have to die in order to live. And the person I was, to a great extent, had to die in order for me to be here today. Something had to go. I named her. Her name was Dora Ferguson. Because there was a time when the police used to ask me what my name was, and I was afraid Mother might find out if I gave my right name, so I said I was Dora. And someone had called me that once because I had gone into a new profession, and the woman in the house said that I was so dumb, I didn't know a thing about my business, and she started calling me Dumb Dora. And then they needed the last name, and I remembered old Ma Ferguson, the governors of Texas, and I thought it'd serve them right, so I called myself Dora Ferguson. Alias Penny Singleton and several other aliases. But Dora had to be done away with some way. Because she was one of these. Have you ever heard that song, "I Must Go Where the Wild Goose Goes"? Well, that was Dora. She was a wild goose if you ever saw one. There was nothing that girl wouldn't do to get another drink. In fact, she got in such trouble that she thought she was going to the penitentiary one time. Because alcohol was what brought Dora to life, this other self of mine. When I wasn't drinking, I tried to be Marguerite, that was the little white saint in the Baptist church. Because I'd gone to church all my life, and I used to pray for the heathen in China and the missionaries overseas and the ladies' auxiliary, and I used to pray for those sinners out there at ball games on Sunday and going to movies on Sunday and going straight to hell. You know, I prayed for all those folks. But I didn't think that I would ever need any such prayers. So certainly I was a good girl. Marguerite was a good girl. She was right. But once I started drinking, then Dora took over. And she was a hoodlum of the first water. All these hidden things that Marguerite had wanted to do all her life, she was able to do with no scruples once I had taken a drink. I was very open to suggestion. Mother and Daddy got in my way when I was drinking. And the baby got too much for me to handle. And my husband in the insane asylum, so I moved to the city. I thought I was going to get a good job and make a life, new life. I started more new lives than a cat. They've just got nine, but I have started many more new lives than that. I moved to Dallas where I had no restrictions whatsoever. I stayed up as late as I wanted to. I drank where I wanted to as much. I got in all sorts of trouble, but it was just like a daze. Having no authority over me was a very dangerous thing, and I just went down, 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 like a roller coaster. I left there, went on a magazine tour, and I couldn't sell magazines. I had never been good at any job all my drinking life. I tried to be a magazine sales lady, a waitress, jack of all trades and master of none. We'd have to move around a lot when we're drinking because I got fired from nearly every job I had, or I just got drunk and never went back to pick up the paycheck. Anyhow, I went up north and tried to sell these magazines and nobody would buy them. I'd go in the bars and I'd just stay all day. They wouldn't buy a magazine, but they'd buy me a drink. And I was just in my early 20s, and naturally you get offers to buy your drink in bars, so I just sit down and spend the day with them. And they come around at night to pick us up and ask me how many magazines I'd sold, why I hadn't sold any, and I was just rolling drunk. So they fired me in Chicago, and that's when I made another great discovery in my life. I found out if I got drunk enough where I wasn't afraid, I could get out to the edge of town, any town in this United States, and put my thumb up and get a ride for nothing. Well, I used to say it was for nothing. It really wasn't for nothing. I found out. But that was another dangerous thing for me to know because, like I said, I was an escape artist. And any time I got in a jam or life wasn't going to suit me or people got mean to me, I got out on the side of the road with my little jug and I hitchhiked clear across the country. Dallas to Los Angeles, Chicago down to Houston. I didn't stop in Greenville because the closer I got to Greenville, that place where Mother and Daddy were, I just couldn't go in. I had to keep going. So from the magazines, I went down there, and I had remembered a time going in this place, slumming, I said to myself. It had a big sign out front, 50 pretty girls, and it was old Rosalind Dank's house. And I thought, that's what I'll do. I can't sober up enough to get a good job, and my clothes are all dirty. So, and I forget then whether my teeth were in or out, because they seem like all my life they've either been knocked out or I just had a new bridge put in, so it's hard to remember. But I got a job up the old Roseland, and they bought tickets for a nickel in the summer and a dime in the winter. And I thought, boy, you money-making thing, I'd make nearly $1.50 every night. And the music was loud, and I remember in the summertime how those windows were open and everybody just sweating like hogs and dancing to those old, loud trumpet. And when I wasn't real drunk, I enjoyed some of it because I maybe get to go to parties. When I was growing up, I was too skinny. Nobody asked me. So that was sort of a party every night for me, but I got fired from the old Roseland. I don't know if anybody else ever did, but because they were glad to get young girls in there. But me, they fired. They said that I had brought the vice squad to their dignified establishment. They had always tried to keep up and have a nice reputation, and it was ruining them. And I didn't mean to do that. It was just that I saw the tracks of trouble. I lived in a house with an older woman that was in the house, and we became friends. And so one night she called me up to the room and said, "Will you take this little paper sack down to Charlie at the bar?" Well, Charlie was her husband. So without really knowing what I was doing and high-strung, I carried over $1,800 from her room down to Charlie at the bar on the corner. And the police got me, and they ran off. So that's when I nearly went to prison for grand larceny, and I was drunk all the time. I didn't know anything was going on until after it was over, and I knew what I had done. But that's the way you get in prison, I think, so many times, drunk. We don't really remember what we're doing. We don't know how we got there or much what we did, because I started blacking out when I was very young. I got in a whole lot of trouble in Houston, and I swore I'd never go back because I was afraid, well, they told me I'd better leave town. When you get involved with the police, and they'll pick you up if they see you on the street, and I knew then I couldn't quit drinking. So I went on back somewhere else. I was always going, running from something to something, running from misery to heaven, because I just knew that this day or the next hill or just across two or three states, there must be some little corner where I'd just sit and there'd be flowers and orange trees out there in California. And I was always running because tomorrow was going to be different. Tomorrow was the answer to everything. People back home in Greenville said, I didn't love my little Johnny, because I didn't get home too often, about 3 or 4 months. Every 3 or 4 months, I'd get poured in the house drunk. They lived out at the farm, and I hated the farm. And I'd go in drunk, and Mama would cry and pray, and Daddy would cuss and use bad words. And I said later, I respected Daddy's point of view much better than Mother's. I couldn't stand that praying and crying, and how can you do this to me? And all that, but Daddy said you ought to take all these alcoholics out, line them up, and shoot them down like dogs. And I thought, well, at least he had a positive attitude. But when all that whining, you know, I knew where he stood. I understood that. Anyhow, I was always guilty around there because they said I didn't want my baby, and if I was halfway a woman, I'd take him with me, or I'd get married again and have a home and all that sort of thing. And people just don't, the world out there, don't realize how much women really, truly love their children. They may not act like it most of the time, but I know that I realized that sometimes when I was acting the worst, I was loving the most. It's hard to explain, but no one ever loved any child like I did that one. And I would hurt for him when I find myself in jail, places, couldn't get out, and I think, oh, if I could just go home and feel him again, because in the summertime, they have on those little soft gowns, and they're real little. They're so soft and loving and such a comfort to rock and sing to and all that, and I would cry for him. I think if I could just get back home. And we was always telling, just making this little story between us about someday that we would get a house and live together. And I'd lie to him, and I'd believe the lie that someday I'd come get him, and we'd have this little white house, and we'd live together forever. And he would just go in, and you know how kids get so delighted, even with a lie, and he'd want me to tell it over and over and over. Tell it again, Mama, and I'd tell it again. And for a little while, we'd both be real happy. I knew it was inside that it was a lie, that I couldn't get him. I didn't know how. I was either broke or jacked up with something, or too drunk, too intoxicated to handle any situation. There was no way. And I remember when it started, this waking up in some old diesel truck engine, and I remembered some words that, and even drunk and hungover, they comforted me. We have to have something to comfort us. And I remember this thing I heard in church of, in my father's house and in a mansion. If it were not so, I wouldn't have told you. And I thought maybe God in his mercy
We set aside one small house for Johnny because I knew I never could. There are comforts along the way, even drunk and hurting and dirty. I tried to straighten up many, many times, but it just went from bad to worse. I mean, I got fired out at Roseland, and I had to leave Houston because they said in time they saw me, they'd pick me up. So I went on back to Greenville, and I decided that I was going to try to stay sober, but it didn't last, and I would walk from the farm clear into town because Daddy wouldn't take me. He knew I'd run away. So I got over there, and I started working in these B-girl dives along close to the bus station, if some of you have ever been in Dallas, and they didn't want me there. I was getting to feel like, where in the world did I really belong? Because even the hoodlums didn't want me. I drank too much for them. They didn't want me being a big girl because I got drunk, and they wanted sober girls. They'd drink grape juice and make money for them. But I would get drunk, and they let me go. And then I remember this waiter I had met up Phil Roseland, and I'd heard a lot of people talking in jail. You get a liberal education in jail, and they had talked about things that I hadn't known about prior to that, but there was a demand for certain commodities that I didn't know anything at all about. So they said in Galveston, it was this merchant singer went in there, and you could really get well financially. So I kept listening, and the day came when I got drunk enough and broke enough and sick enough, I just thought, why not? You know what you're doing. Why not? So I ended up down there, and I stayed about a year. But to me, it did color the rest of my existence. I think there's some things we can do that, although we forgive ourselves, it haunts us many, many years. That's why I'm always so glad if someone who is turned a little bit crazy like I was can find herself soon enough, find this program that she won't have to go the whole dirty route and have so many, many things to try to forget or live with. I went there and I stayed drunk, half loaded. You can't stay drunk. You have to sober up once in a while. That's the horrible part of it. If you could just get drunk and stay drunk, it would be wonderful. Then you wouldn't have to feel and you could just go on and die. But there comes a time when I can't hold it on my stomach. And up it comes, and those times you just die a little bit. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror down there, and I had to have another drink to stay there at all. Finally, I did get away. I nearly got killed before I got out of town, but I got run out of Galveston, really. Sometimes we piddle with bias, and we don't realize we're in so deep until we're there. I didn't know that there was something like a syndicate that controlled some things down there. I didn't know that there was this big, many armed organization that I was just a mere speck in. I didn't realize that those women that were washed up on the beach there in Galveston were murdered. A woman's life in the particular place I was in was not worth a red nickel if she didn't do toe the line in many respects. I didn't realize till later that I was playing with fire and didn't know it, and it's a thousand wonders I'm alive today. And the way I got beaten and run out of town, I talk too much when I'm drunk, like many of you. And I'd go out to a bar that stayed open all night, and someone asked me a question, I'd tell them the truth, usually. So I told too many truths, and that's what got me in trouble, and I couldn't call the police because they were part of it. I couldn't call a taxi to get out of town because they were part of it. In fact, my second husband was a cab driver. He was also my business manager, to put it nicely. I couldn't call them, so I walked out of there. I ran away. They had tied me down with a bartender. Let me loose, and I got out and walked and got outside and got a ride. But it's dangerous, a lush in some places like that. Anyhow, that was an awakening of sorts. I went back home to Greenville, and I didn't drink, and I didn't have dates, and I didn't go to Dallas. It was a very negative program of not doing things I knew would get me in trouble. And I took a business course and tried to better my life, and I'd go out to the farm to see my little boy every weekend. And I wasn't happy, but I wasn't so miserable either. I needed to drink many times, but I sure didn't take it, because I knew by then what one drink would do. And I went to Washington, D.C. during the war, when they were recruiting secretaries. I went up there and got drunk after a year of sobriety, I got drunk in the club car and arrived there drunk, and I lasted about, oh, I guess 6 months. Not very long, because I was sick with female trouble. I called in and said, well, I was sick Monday and then I was sick Tuesday. And I was sick so much they started asking me what was the trouble, and I just got old face for female trouble, because they won't ask you too many questions. If it's a man asking you, you know, you can get by with it. But they fired me too. And I said, to hell with the Americans, I'll go to work for the English. So I went to the India Supply Mission, and I started working for the English government. So I was sick a lot there, and then my fingerprints came back. But they have done that to me so many times, and that's one thing I have to live with, that if I go to work someplace that has a security check, sooner or later, if they take my fingerprints and take a mugshot, it's going to come back. And they're going to know all about me. So that's what the English did to me. They called me in and they said, look here, why didn't you tell us about this? And I just, left. And then, too, the nurse came out one day, and I had gotten very lonely and very drunk at the same time, and she knew I lived by myself, but strangely enough, there's a pair of men's shoes under the bed, and she didn't stay too long, but she reported it. So I was a deep dive center there for the English, too. I don't know when exactly the desperation of just being alive started in, but I think it does with all of us. I guess it's when we realize that there's no way we can live without drinking, and we don't know any way to stop. But that time certainly came for me. I had married again, thinking that was the answer. And he'd gone off to sea during the war. And we got a home when he got back, and I had another little baby. And that was another chance to be happy. Well, the second child that I had, he was 10 months old, he got polio. And being a drunk, all I needed to do was get drunk over it. When you hurt, get drunk. Don't let yourself hurt. Don't let your heart get so unhurt. Get drunk instead. Ease the pain. So he was over under the iron lung, in the iron lung, and I was over at the hotel drunk every night, and my mother came out to stay with me. She thought that he was dying. And she cornered me one night and dragged me up out of the bar and talked to me. And she had never done before. And she said that God was punishing me, that I had been not lived the kind of life I was supposed to live. So the good Lord was punishing me by making, well, both boys were over there with polio at the same time, but the other one wasn't real bad off. It was this little one. And it was then that I got this idea that if God is really like that, that he would punish a child and kill it just to get even with its mother. I couldn't believe in a higher power that was like that. So not knowing any other way to believe, because that's the way I was brought up believing. That's what I had in my mind. There was black and white, there's no middle road, and that we were punished and all that kind of stuff. But I just couldn't go on with that belief when I knew that child was dying, and she placed such guilt on me. I think with that, people try to make us stop drinking, and sometimes they only add to our guilt, and that makes us drink more. I guess she thought she was trying to wake me up, But she placed such an unbearable load of guilt on my shoulders, saying, you're the cause of it. God's, your child's dying because God's punishing you for your sins. I heard some words later that described exactly what I did, and I know what some of you did too, and that AA comes of age, Father Dowling, I thought, think, brought out this of the hound of heaven. I fled him down the days and down the nights. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind, and in the midst of tears I hid from him. And that was the way I felt toward any power greater than myself, to run and hide and cry. I used to say in my drunkenness, I hope there's no God. I hope God's dead. And when we were growing up, Mom used to say, if you cut out a dress on Sunday with scissors, you're cutting the flesh of Jesus. And if you used a needle to sew something on Sunday the Sabbath, you were sticking needles in the flesh of Jesus. And in my drunkenness, I used to say, I thought I had scissored and needled you up long ago. I wish there was no God, that if you died, you were just dead and out of your misery, and nothing to account to ever. And I prayed. I don't know what I was praying to, but I certainly wished with all my heart there was no God. I got so awfully sick out there in San Fernando. I got on wine because my husband didn't have much money, and he gave me bread money, and I'd use it for wine. And I just stayed goofy all the time. That old Santa Fe Muscatel. And I'd wait outside that grocery store. I don't know if y'all have ever waited outside a liquor store or bar to open. Well, I'd wait outside those grocery stores out in that little neighborhood for that door to open. I'd get my Muscatel for the day with my bread money. And poor thing, he'd come in at night so tired from working all day. And I would hate him. When Ramona was talking this morning, I really identified, because when that poor man came home from his day's work, all he had to do was come in the door. And I had been sitting there hating him all day. I used to, when he'd get drunk, the only time he'd have the nerve to beat me up was when he'd get drunk. And he'd remember all these things I'd done to him. And he'd just really give me a good one. And when he would, I never committed murder, but I had thought about it. I wanted to so awfully bad. And I'd sit there half drunk, and he'd be asleep. He could sleep through hell itself. I never saw a man that could sleep so good. And I think I just had the nerve to take a beer bottle and bust his brains out. And I got more delight out of seeing the blood and the brains all over the pillow. I thought, I'll get even with him for cutting my lips and knocking my bridge out again and whipping me. And it certainly, I had committed murder in my heart, because I had the sincere desire to kill Hart Crowell, and it's only by the grace of AA and God, as we understand him, he's still alive out in Portland, Oregon. Of course, I don't know how alive he'd be still back in Texas. We're two people that can't get too close together without fighting. So as long as I'm in Texas and he's in Portland, Oregon, we manage to forgive each other and live peacefully and visit occasionally on account of the child, account of little Dennis, it's his boy. But we fought like cats and dogs out there in that little clean village, and they told us, the neighbors said, that we had ruined the reputation of their little village that we lived in out there. They were all hard-working, respectable people, and the police cars were at our house every weekend. We'd get drunk, and I'd try to kill him with a grubbing hoe. I don't know if y'all have ever seen a grubbing hoe, but it's worse than a real hoe. But I'd throw it at him, try to kill him, and he'd turn the hose on me to keep me off of him. And somebody called the police. And then the neighbors would come in, and they'd take my baby out of my arms. And one night, they all took me down to jail in a body. They said that had gone far enough. So that in two cars, they went. When I remember that, it reminds me of the stone throwing, you know, the old biblical days. I wouldn't have been a bit surprised if they had stoned me right there on the spot. Because they gathered in a little knot, the men and women, the respectable citizens of that little foothill village, and they took me to the police to do something about me. And the horrible part was they made me come home with them. I thought if they'd just keep me, it'd have been better. But they made me come back home because my husband was with them. He was on their side. And I had to come back home to face the music. And I would have come back home sooner many, many times. But you know, if you're drunk and married, and you go out drinking one night, run off from home, and you're gone that night, well, the next day you have to drink a little bit more, and you're kind of scared to go home. And the next night, if you stay out that night too, you're really terrified about going back. And I used to get so homesick and want to go home so bad, I'd get so sick, but I was scared to. And I'd have to keep on going from bar to bar, drinking on other people's money. I never had none of my own. I spent half my life waiting in some bar on a stoop with my little 15-cent beer, whatever I could get, waiting for a live one. And there's always some old guy drunker than you are that's going to think you're queen of the May and start buying you drinks. A woman can get by as long as she's got two teeth and half her hair. You know, you don't really have to sober up financially. You know, as well as I do, and that makes it so hard sometimes for some of us old crazy girls to ever get sober, because we don't suffer the silver cure. We can let go of most of our scruples, or certainly as people like me did. I never got killed hitchhiking because I never fought anybody. I just figured that was part of the fair, you know, hitchhiking across the country. A lot of people get killed fighting for their honor. Well, I figured I had none to start with, so why get killed? So I just accepted a lot of things as part of the fair to get from Texas to wherever I was going. It was a desperate sort of resignation to the terrible things in this life. When I came to AA, I was bankrupt physically and mentally and certainly spiritually. Every way a woman could be bankrupt. I couldn't stay married. I couldn't be a mother. My parents were so embarrassed about me and so hurt. I talked to them awfully bad when I was drinking. I told them things that never should have been told. And I wouldn't do it till I got real drunk and hurting, and I knew they disapproved. And I felt so guilty, and then I'd lash out and tell them some things that I never should have told. And I hurt them desperately. When I first read that big book, I thought, it's the answer to my entire life. I never could understand me when I did those things. I thought, here, I want to be good, and I start drinking, and I do these terrible things. And then I wake up with a hangover, and I'm horrified, remembering what I did. And what makes me laugh at it? I've asked myself many, many times in a drunk tank, because I got to be a jailbird, and I could not understand me. I thought I was crazy, or just no good morally, because I had just literally turned into a coast-to-coast tramp. That was the size of it, and I couldn't understand why it had gotten to that point. But when I read that big, well, before I read the big book, I had been out on about a 3-week tear and ended up in Dallas, and my sister lived there. And several weeks before I got there, she and her husband had gone to AA. That's the sister that died lately. Well, I got to her house and cleaned up a little. She let me in dirty and all. Anyhow, they had this the blue pamphlet, A Way of Life. And for the first time in my life, I knew what was wrong with me. It seemed like it just hit me full force. It talked about alcoholism is an illness, and it relieved me of guilt even the first time that I read it, because I had thought I was just downright sorry and no good. And that little book said that I was a sick woman, and that there was a group of people just like me. And if I wanted to badly enough that I would go to any length, I too could get better, could recover from this. And I had never realized that there were that many people in the world that were just like me in their inability to handle a drink. I was just like you. I thought when they made me, they threw away the mold, that there's nobody any worse that drank like I did, that suffered the loneliness that I did. I was entirely alone in my drinking. Because when you shut God out and people out, like to say, just ourselves, we make a darn small package. And I was wrapped up only in myself and my hurt. And then when I got to the big book to read it, it was better still. And it was just one of those things that I got so proud of being a member of AA. I would hear some of them say that they wanted to stay real anonymous, and I understood that. And I fully believe in anonymity. I know it's the spiritual foundation of our program. But there in the beginning, I wanted to keep the cover on that old big book. I wanted people to see that I was a member of AA. Because when they called me an alcoholic, it was a promotion. It gave me dignity. I felt I'm just as good as anybody else. I'm not the no good creature I thought I was. I am an alcoholic. And I was so glad. I don't know anyone that ever felt any more relief at being an alcoholic. I wanted to take that big book to everybody I had ever known and make them read it. Talk about carrying the message. I wanted to carry it to those folks that didn't understand me first. I thought if I could take it to that old matron in Dallas that kept nodding her head and saying, "You'll be back, you'll be back," every time I'd get out of jail. I wanted to take it to her and show her and say, "Read this paragraph here. This tells you why I was a jailbird. I wasn't really a jailbird. Says here, I'm fixed." And I thought if I could just take it and make Mama read it. Mama has never understood the 12 steps of AA. One time I went into all the steps fully in detail, explaining it was not willpower, that we had to trust God as we understood him, keep us sober one day at a time. I gave her the whole pitch. Took me about an hour to explain AA to Mama. And when I got through, she said, "Mama knew you could do it. All it took was a little willpower." And that's when I quit trying to explain AA to my parents. They just don't understand. But that big book, the only way I can describe it, it was a badge of honor. And I carried it with me. I went to the club when they opened in the morning and stayed till they locked the door at night. And I wanted to carry that book. I thought sure that somebody on the buses or the streetcars every day would see it, and surely one of them would have a problem, and they'd come up and say, "Oh, I see you're a member of AA. I want to discuss my problem with you," but nobody ever come up and ask me that. But I sure wanted them to. That's why I wanted to carry the book. Just like a preacher in his Bible, I could go to my meetings with my book in hand. AA has done everything for me that I ever dreamed of. In the beginning, to be able to respect myself was a healing thing. Because I knew that I was a sick person and that if I followed the program, I could get well because the other women there were getting well. Or recovering. I don't guess I'll ever be well. I am a recovering alcoholic and certainly not recovered, because each day is a new deal. And I have to ask God in the morning for help and thank him at night for another day of sobriety. Don't make no difference how many years we've been sober. That's something never changes. We can't stand on our laurels and say, "Well, isn't it fine? I stayed sober 10 years or 16 years. That don't count for a hill of beans, except that it's that much more insurance of sobriety today to me. But that doesn't relieve me of the necessity of making a contract when I get up in the morning and being grateful for that day's sobriety, because it is a gift. I certainly didn't never earn it. There's no way I could buy it. And one day at a time, I have the gift of life. And the older I get, the more I realize how wonderful it is just to be alive. I used to think so much about doing something that would hurt my soul. And the older I get, the more I think about something that will kill me. We see so many women that are my age that go back to drinking or pills, or those who haven't really found the program yet. We had gone in, and some would be. There was one girl that died on her head. She fell over the commode in the corner of the bathroom. And she was dead about 3 days when they found her. And you can imagine what it was like. I want to live. What happens other than that is all bonus. The important thing to me is having found God, a God that I could talk to, that loves me. He don't care what I did yesterday. He loves me. He forgave me. And even that I am a sensualist, I know that to a great extent. I love to feel velvet. I love to feel warm rain. I like to go out the beach and feel sand. I like to feel with the senses. I get such a great pleasure out of feeling things. The simple things are just living. Every time I see a sunset this year, I thought, Lizzie, why couldn't you wait? I mean, it's so good just to feel the goodness of this life and the friends in it. And I know she didn't deliberately kill herself, but the thought comes, why couldn't you wait just a little longer? Life is so good, and I'm grateful for every minute of it. Had it not been for the program of AA and the people in it that really, truly cared for me, before I could care for myself, I'd be dead. I love you, every one of you. Even if I don't know you, if you're an alcoholic, or the wife of one, or the family of one, you're my people. And you took the place of the people that had lost respect for me. My mother and daddy, they have forgiven me, I suppose. And I go back home, and they treat me real good now. And both my children treat me real fine. Everything's all right. But these are my people here. We love and understand each other. Thank you.